Now that we got most of the riffraff out, Brother Lewis is still back there, so it's not all gone yet. It's a blessing that having the kids up here at the beginning really adds to the service, so we enjoy doing that. But I'm looking around. Most of us are grandparents here, and we love the kids, but we also love when they go back home. So this is just the right way to do it. We are going to try to do that this Sunday. Bring them up for the beginning like this, so please be mindful of that. And then when we dismiss them, teachers take them back downstairs, and someone will be down there from our church trying to give the Bruners the day off. Let them relax and enjoy what's going on here since we got someone else teaching junior church that day. So I'll have someone else down there to see the kids and then introduce the Hinkles to them, and they will teach them Sunday morning. So we're looking forward to that. All right, if you can do this with me. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 Kings, 2 Kings, 1 Chronicles, 2 Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Job. There we are. The book of Job. Job and Malachi are the two that we have to watch them. This is the book of Job. It is the first of the what we call poetical books. All right? The first 17 books we just concluded are all called historical books. Starting with Genesis and going all the way through Esther. Those are historical. The next five books are going to be poetical. Now we say poetical, Hebrew poetry is not like English poetry. Doesn't necessarily rhyme, but if you've read Job or if you've read Psalms and many times Proverbs, you know that there's a meter to the verses. You can we sing several. The law of the Lord is perfect. All right, there's a meter to these, so that in its sense is a sense of poetry. And yet, really, another title for the next five books is almost more fitting than the books of poetry, and that is the books of wisdom. Starting with Job and Psalms and Proverbs, Ecclesiastes and Song of Solomon. These are also called the five books of wisdom. So these next five we'll be looking as we start with Job. I don't know if you can notice, but I had to stretch the page on my computer program to get everything in on Job, and I couldn't get in another third of what I wanted to get in. The book of Job is just such an amazing book. It is, as we see here, it is the first and oldest book ever written. The first and oldest book ever written. Again, before Moses wrote Genesis, Job's book was written. So it is the oldest book ever written. Now, there were other things written. There's a thing called the Book of the Dead that preceded the book of Job. But the Book of the Dead was never a book. It was pieces of paper found in different coffins in Egypt. And they took the different pieces of paper out. It was never written in one book. This is the oldest continuous book that's ever been written, is the book of Job. And so that's what we're looking at tonight, the oldest book. And yet, though it's the oldest book, we're going to be surprised at the vast amount of knowledge that's in it. It is written by a fellow named Elihu. And I'm turning over to chapter 32, and I hope you can get this. It's kind of, you kind of got to read it on your own later to really understand it. As you know, in the book of Job, it's Job suffering and his three friends, quote unquote, coming around and harassing him for why he's going through his suffering. And we'll see in just a minute, there's three rounds of the three friends. They all speak three times. Job answers each of them. Then they all speak a second time. Job answers them. Then the first two of them speak the third time. But then after that, this other man, Elihu, a young man who has kept his mouth shut up to this point. He's the smartest of all of them. He kept his mouth shut up to this point, but at the end of that third round, he speaks up. And we know he's the writer because of the way he presents it. In chapter 32, it says in verse 2, "Then was kindled the wrath of Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite, of the kindred of Ram. Against Job was his wrath kindled, because he justified himself rather than God. Also against his three friends, Was his wrath kindled because he had found no answer and yet condemned Job? Now Elihu had waited till Job had spoken because they were elder than he. When Elihu saw that there was no answer in the mouth of these three men, then his wrath was kindled. And Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite, answered and said, I am young and ye are very old. Whereunto I was afraid and durst not show you my opinion. I said, days should speak and multitude of years should teach wisdom. Verse 10, therefore I said, hearken to me, I will also show mine opinion. Now that phrase, therefore I said, if you read this through, there's something unusual about that. The writer is saying that. The writer is saying, therefore I said, all right? He's speaking in the first person here. And it's especially evident when he says down in verse 15, they were amazed, they answered no more, they left off speaking. When I had waited, all right? That's what the writer is saying. When I had waited, for they spake not, but stood still and answered no more, I said, I will answer also my part, I will also show mine opinion. Chapter 32, at least that part right there, is written by Elihu. Now again, the scholars and all these folks that are too educated for their own good say that the rest of the book of Job was already written, and Elihu came and added chapter 32 later. There's no indication. He was there from the very beginning and heard all the speeches by all the men. Most people say Moses wrote the book of Job, but it's very evident by these verses in Job 32 that Elihu was the writer of the book of Job, and it answers the question, the famous theme, why do the righteous suffer? All right, why do the righteous suffer? Why do those that try to do so right suffer anyways? And the book of Job is our answer for that question. We know why Job suffered. He was, according to chapter 1, he was an upright man, one that feared God and eschewed evil. He was perfect according to the word of God. And yet look what he goes through. That's why sometimes the righteous suffer. Now sometimes we suffer for sin. Sometimes we suffer the consequences of bad decisions. But the suffering Job goes through is from none of the above. He goes through it simply because the devil had a target on his back and wanted, it was a spiritual battle between God and the devil over whether Job would do right in the midst of very trying circumstances. The last line there says this, it shows that great suffering is not always the result of great sin. Great suffering is not always the result of great sin. When someone is stricken at a young age with a devastating disease, sometimes we jump the gun and say, well, I wonder what they did. But it might be absolutely nothing. It might be a spiritual trial, a spiritual test. It might be that God said, you see that person down there, said to the devil, you see that young person down there, they're a good person, they love me with all their heart, and there's nothing you can do to change their mind. The devil says, well, let me touch them just for a moment, let's see. That goes on according to the book of Job, because that's exactly what happened with Job. So it's an evidence that all suffering is not always the result of sin. Now, sometimes it is. There is chastisement. I'm studying the book of Psalms, and I gotta go to Psalm 50. I'm in 41, 42, 43, I think I was working on today. And David suffered sickness. I think Psalm 43 is out. David's sickness, David's suffering, David's supplication. Alright, his sin, his sickness. David committed sin with Bathsheba. He contracted a disease because of that. All right. So sometimes sin is a result, or sickness is a result of sin, but not necessarily. And Job teaches us that. All right. The book of Job, a great vast book. It is a book of, but it is a book of philosophy. These three wise friends of Job, they are each patriarchs of their different respective families. And each of these three men give an immense amount of wisdom. The only problem is it's human wisdom. It's human understanding. They're misjudging Job. There's a lot of folks with a lot of good human reasoning, but they don't have the spiritual sense God gave a donkey. All right? When it comes to spiritual matters, they don't have a clue. Now, they will try to spill over. They'll try to think because they're so intellectual on these areas that they have all the answers for spiritual things too, and they just show their ignorance when they do that. So the book of Job is a book of philosophy, the philosophy of the three philosophers that were wrong in falsely accusing Job. It's also a book of theology. That doesn't surprise us. But again, remember, this book was written. It's the first book written, and yet it's got theology in it. This book was written before Moses. Job makes sacrifices for his own children in chapter 1 because there is no priesthood established yet. Moses and Aaron have not done all that. This book precedes all of that thing. It's before the law. And yet it teaches us about omnipotence. We'll not look at the references, but chapter 9, verse 12, chapter 23 and verse 13, that God is all-knowing. Job understood that. It talks about redemption. I love that verse 19:25. I know that my Redeemer liveth. Job knew about a Redeemer. May I say this? If Job is the first book written, he had no Bible. He had no other book of the Bible when this was written. And yet there was an understanding in him of the omnipotence, the all-powerfulness of God, that there was a Redeemer. Retribution in chapter 34, that the wicked do receive for the deeds they do, and the good receive rewards for the deeds they do. That was all understood by somebody that didn't even have a Bible yet. How sad it is in our day that people that have a Bible and access to it can't get those things down. They know nothing about God's omnipotence, that He is the Redeemer, that there is a thing called retribution. We will give an answer for the things that are done. So it's a book of theology. It's also a book of science. Job is a science book. There are statements made in the book of Job on the physical sciences that were not discovered till centuries afterward. Chapter 37 and verse number 16. Dost thou know the balancing of the clouds? The wondrous works of Him which is perfect in knowledge. You know, the study of clouds wasn't developed for a long time after the book of Job was written. And yet Job had a knowledge and an insight into the sciences of those very things. Chapter 38, verse 22. Hast thou entered into the treasures of the snow, or hast thou seen the treasures of the hail, which I have reserved against the time of trouble, against the day of battle of war? All right, there's science is mentioned. It's all through the Bible. I could have put this oceanography. We could have said that Job's a book of oceanography because he talks about the waves and the currents and the streams. Sciences that weren't invented until years later. The Bible was way ahead of everybody else. It's also a book of astronomy. In chapter 38, we read about these four different constellations. Pleiades, Orion, Maseroth, and Arcturus. Those galaxies and the skies and the universe that are out there. Job knew about them. They're written in the book of Job, chapter 38. You know, science didn't find out about those till a long, long time after that. Job, the book of Job tells us things that man took a long time to figure out after that. It's a book of history. Job, of course, being the first book written, it's that much closer to creation. And so there's a lot said about creation in chapter 26, how God put the universe together. Also the flood in chapter 22, verse 15 and 16. These things are mentioned. Those were history. Again, we know where the book belongs historically, way back there, because no mention of Moses, no mention of the Exodus, no mention of the Passover, none of these things. This precedes all of those things and yet talks about all these subjects. And then prophecy, that's the big one. Prophecy. The book of Job has an underlying prophetic theme. The name Job means persecuted. That's what the name Job is. You type in, what does Job mean on Google? It'll say it means persecuted. Job is a type of Israel who in the tribulation period is going to be persecuted. Israel is going to be persecuted for 7 years. You know how long Job sat in his boils? Back in chapter 2 it says 7 days and 7 nights. Alright, the number 7 is not a coincidence. One day for each year that Israel is going to be persecuted. The suffering takes place in the land of Edom, according to Lamentations. It's in Uz, which is in the land of Edom. That's what Lamentations 4:21 says. And that's the same place that Israel will be tried in the tribulation, according to Isaiah 63, verse 1. There's a lot more to the Bible than that which meets the eye. Job has 42 chapters. One for each month of the great tribulation, the last 3.5 years of the tribulation when Israel's suffering is so intense and so great and the devil's got them marked. These things are not just a coincidence. Those numbers are there for a reason. 42 chapters, and Job gets everything back at the end that he had when he started with. And that's a picture of the Jew during the tribulation. They're going to get the kingdom. Alright, so then it's about prophecy. Also in prophecy, the second advent. And again, that's one I made reference to already, but let's look at that because that's kind of the hub of the book of Job. Chapter 19 and verse 25, Job says this, "For I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. And though after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God." That's a pretty good statement of knowledge for somebody that lived 2000 BC. That's pretty good for somebody that didn't have a Bible to go to, didn't have a preacher to listen to, didn't have a Old Testament priest to make sacrifices, and yet he knew that his Redeemer was going to live, he was going to stand upon the earth, and that he would in his flesh see God. Job in his flesh, because he'll be resurrected. He's going to see God. So it's a book of prophecy. One of the other great things about the book of Job is that the first two chapters teach us more about the devil than we learn anywhere else in the Bible, because we see him in action. Back in chapter 1 of Job, the Bible says in chapter 1 and verse number 6, "Now there was a day when the sons of God," those are angels, "came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them." The angels have to give a report to God. They have to have a business meeting. I don't know if it's every Tuesday morning at 10, but they have a certain time that they have to appear before God and give an account of what they've been doing for the week. And the devil, as an angel, though a fallen angel, he has to appear with them. He is required by God to show up for that business meeting as regularly as it's held. So we know this, our first line. He has access to God. A-C-C-E-S-S. He has access to God before the throne. You know, the Bible says in another place that even the heavens are not clean in his sight. Right now, Satan's the prince and power of the air. Right now, the devil still gets to go to heaven. In fact, he's required to show up in heaven every time there's a meeting held. And God requires his presence there. That's why in the book of Revelation, that heaven where God actually sits now is going to be done away with and going to be replaced by something called a New Jerusalem. We'll get to that in our Sunday night studies of Revelation. But even that very place, the throne room of God, right now, the devil is required. Chapter 2, verse 1. "Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them to present himself before the Lord." He is required to do so. Number 2, or the second line here, "He is aware of those who are true to God and desires to harm them." He is aware of those that are true to God and desires to harm them. Chapter 1, verse 9, "Satan answered the Lord and said, Doth Job fear God for naught? Hast thou not made a hedge about him and about his house and about all that he hath on every side? Thou hast blessed the work of his hands, and his substance is increased in the land. But put forth thine hand now and touch all that he hath, and he will curse thee to thy face." The devil desires for the people of God to be tested and tried. He cannot act against such people or such men without divine permission. God could have stopped Job from doing anything, the devil from doing anything to Job if he wanted to, but he allowed him to do it. Doesn't that bring up the question, why? Have you ever asked God why? Lord, why am I going through this? Lord, why is this happening to me? Lord, why? We're going to find that that's a key word in our key words down here in just a few minutes. That's going to be one of them. Why? The devil cannot act against such without divine permission. Chapter 1, verse 12, "The Lord said to Satan, Behold, all that he hath is in thy power. Only upon himself put not forth thine hand." You can touch everything he has, but not his body. Then later in chapter 2, he says, all right, you can touch his body, but you can't take his life. The devil can only do what God permits him to do. God is more powerful than the devil. Tell that to Bysville's Sanctuary of Satan, or whatever they call themselves. God is more powerful than the devil. The devil has to bow before him and answer to him. He cannot act against such men without divine permission. Then the next line. He is aware that God protects his own. He is aware that God protects his own. The devil said in verse 10 of chapter 1, "Hast thou not made a hedge about him, and about his house, and about all that he hath on every side?" The truth of Scripture is that God puts his hedge about you. We often pray that, "Lord, put a hedge round about them. Protect them." The Ten Commandments are a hedge. The commandments of God and the rules and regulations of Scripture are a hedge. We say, "I don't want anybody confining me. I don't want anybody telling me my boundaries." Well, go ahead and disobey God and go outside the hedge then. And take your chances. Because the devil's waiting out there for somebody to come sneaking through that hedge. So, he cannot go beyond the bounds set by the Lord. The next line, he can control, or did I skip one? He cannot go beyond the bounds set by the Lord. Chapter 1, verse 12. Again, you can touch his stuff, but not his body. You can touch his body, but you can't kill him. And then he can control armies. He can control armies. Chapter 1 and verse 15. The Sabaeans fall upon Job's cattle and slay them. Was that just a coincidence? No, that was the devil permitted by God to do that. And he raised up an army to do that. Also down in verse number 17, the Chaldeans made three bands and fell upon the camels and slew the servants with the edge of the sword. So the devil has the ability to control armies. That's why, again, in the book of Revelation, all those armies of the east moving against the nation of Israel to fight at the Battle of Armageddon, the devil instigates that. Not only can he control armies, but he can control the weather. Oh, yes, he can. He can send a rainstorm during the week of tent meeting. And he usually does. He can control the weather, according to chapter 1, verse 16. While he was speaking, there came also another and said, "The fire of God has fallen from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants." The devil had the power to do that. Verse 19, "Behold, there came a great wind from the wilderness and smote the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young men." The devil controlled the wind. He controlled the fire. He can afflict the body. Chapter 2 and verse 7. "So went Satan forth from the presence of the Lord and smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot unto his crown." Sore boils. Anybody have a problem understanding what sore boils are? Boils, you know what those are, aren't you? It's funny, the commentators say, "Well, that means he got leprosy." Well, that's not what it says. That means he had a tumor. No, it says sore boils. Don't try to explain what we understand. Explain the stuff we don't understand. But I don't trust those guys, because when they try to explain what I do understand and come out wrong, how am I going to trust them on the other things? All right. Say, he can afflict the body, and then lastly there, he can kill. That should be chapter 1 and verse 19, chapter 2, verse 19. "But there was a great wind that fell upon the young men, and they are dead. And I only escaped to tell thee." The devil had the power to kill Job's 7 sons and 3 daughters. He couldn't touch Job because God didn't give him permission to kill him, but he was able to take his sons and daughters. So that's what we learn about the devil. Now look at the key words in the book of Job, which again follows along with what we're looking at. The title Almighty appears in the book of Job 31 times. 31 times. And that's interesting, because if I got my number right, it's only in the Bible 57 times, Almighty. So over half of those times is in the book of Job. That's, again, he didn't have the advanced revelation we have, but he knew he was Almighty. Now again, I would say he knew he was Creator, and he knew he was Redeemer, but the main thrust was he knew him as Almighty. So we can't go back to Job and say, "Well, you didn't know God." No, he just called, you know, again, folks go back to George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, all those guys say they didn't know the God we know because they didn't say Jesus. Well, that's incorrect, first of all. But then they say, and they talk about providence, providence, providence. Well, we talked about that last Wednesday with providence. All right. Job called him Almighty, Almighty, Almighty. It's the same God. The word "why" appears 16 times, and it's always with a question mark at the end of the sentence. Why? Lord, why? Why do these things happen? Why do some people suffer? Why do others not suffer? Why do the wicked sometimes seem to get away with it? That was Job's big question. Why do the wicked sometimes seem to get away with everything while the righteous suffer? So the word why is predominant. Not only that, but the word how appears 26 times. Lord, how is it? How can this happen? How can this be? The word wicked appears 37 times. And the word wisdom appears 23 times. Again, these are two themes of the book of Job, about the wicked prospering and not being judged. But again, retribution in chapter 32, one of these days they will. You not get away for it with ever, and that wisdom teaches us that. All right, that brings us to the overview of Job. And again, this is looking at the whole book as a picture. Chapters 1 to 3 are about Job's distress. Job's distress. Chapters 1 to 3. Again, I didn't put all the blanks in there so that we don't have to take the time to fill all the words in, but notice chapter 1, verse 1 to 5 talk about his blessings, his substance, according to, verse 2, 7 sons and 3 daughters, his substance in verse 3, 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 she asses, and a very great household, so that this man was the greatest of all the men of the East. All right, those are his blessings. And then verse 4 and 5, he goes and sacrifices for his children to make sure that they're right with God. Again, this is preceding the priesthood and the law of Moses. So every man did that for himself, as Abraham did. So his blessings. Then in verse 6 to 17, obviously we know his bankruptcy. Right, he lost his sheep and his camels. He lost his oxen and his donkeys. He lost everything that he had, his bankruptcy. Then letter C is his bereavement, chapter 18 to 22, and that's when he lost his 7 sons and his 3 daughters. Job had everything taken away from him. I heard somebody saying the other day, he said, think about it. He said, the devil took away all his possessions, took away everything he owned, took away his children, but left his wife. That doesn't say a whole lot of good things about his wife, does that? And of course, she shows up in chapter 2 telling him, curse God and die. So that might be a reason he left her there, to try to be that kind of an influence. We'll talk about that more in just a minute. But chapter 2 then is about his boils. God struck him with the boils from the top of his head to the bottom of his feet, where he had to scrape himself with a piece of pottery to keep those things scraped off as they... I don't want to get gross tonight, but you know what boils do, and they get pussy and all that. And he had to try to cleanse himself that way. So the boils. And then chapter 3 is about Job's bitterness. Chapter 3 and verse 1, after this Job opened Job his mouth and cursed his day. He said in verse number 16, he wished he'd been as an untimely birth, as infants which never saw light. Again, I like the wording of the Bible, infants which never saw light. That's talking about a baby in the mother's womb. Infants that never, not fetuses, infants that never saw light. The Bible describes that baby inside the womb as an infant in God's sight. Not a future life source, not a life possibility, but a child, a real live thing. So that's his bitterness in chapter 3. So chapters 1 to 3, Job's distress. Second of all, chapters 4 to 37, Job's defense. Job's defense. He had to defend himself several times. Actually, 8. As we said, round 1 in chapter 4 to 14, each of his 3 friends speaks, and after each of them speak, Job answers longer than what they said. So that's all in chapters 4 to 14. Then the second round, it happens all again. The same 3 friends in the same order all give a little speech. Job answers each one of them, and his speech is longer than theirs. Then in round 3, chapters 22 to 37, the first 2 friends speak. Job answers them. But then the third one, at that point, the friends just say, all right, we give up. We're not going to answer anymore. That's when the young man Elihu, the writer of the book, finally speaks up and corrects Job, as well as the 3 friends. So that's Job's defense in those chapters. Then number 3, Job's deliverance. Chapters 38 to 42. Job's deliverance. These are I'd have to say the greatest chapters in the book of Job. Because this is God speaking. This is after all the mess is over, after all the debate is done between Job and his three friends and Elihu, God finally puts them all in their place and says, "All right, you think you're so smart? Tell me this, would you?" And God, "Where were you when I did this? Where were you when I did that? Do you understand this? Do you understand that?" God, here's our thing, letter A, how he was humbled. Chapter 38 and verse 1 to chapter 42 and verse 6. How Job was humbled. That's what God had to do. He had to humble him to shut him up. I think sometimes we put ourselves in a position just like Job's where God's got to humble us to shut us up. We think we're so much. We think we know so much. And God says, "You think you know so much?" There's a lot of things we don't have a clue about. There's a lot of things that is as smart as mankind is, we're just scratching the surface when it comes to God. He had to be humbled before he was honored. And that's our letter B. How he was honored. God told Job's three friends, "You better have Job pray for you and make a sacrifice for you because you're not right with God." They berailed him for all those chapters. That's what makes it, folks, the lesson we learn from that is to be very careful in judging someone else. Because in judging someone else, God might require it at our hand. We get harsh on someone else, we're asking God to get harsh on us. We get rough on someone else, we're asking God to get rough on us. So we need to be very careful in our judgment of other people. Now there's times where we need to pass judgment. There are times. He that is spiritual judgeth all things, the Bible says. We need to make those judgments. But when dealing with others, Job's three friends, we said this 100 times, if they'd have come as they did at the very beginning and sat there with their mouths shut and just kept their mouths shut the whole time, they would have turned out a lot better than they did. But they opened their mouth, they showed their foolishness, they tried to give their earthly philosophy, and at the end of it, God honored Job by saying to the three men, "You've made a mistake, I'm going to have Job pray for you. He was right, you're wrong." And then God notices, number one, his critics are rebuked. That's what I'm talking about now. His critics are rebuked. And then his wealth is restored. And we're going to close with this, and I want you to think about this for just a moment. His wealth is restored. In chapter 42 and verse 12. "So the Lord blessed the latter end of Job more than his beginning. For he had 14,000 sheep." Now, if you remember, all the way back in chapter 1 and verse number 3, you can compare these later. Chapter 1, verse 3, he had 7,000 sheep. So after this is all over, God gives him 14,000 sheep. He doubles it for getting through this trial as good as he did. "For he had 14,000 sheep and 6,000 camels." Chapter 1 and verse 3, he had 3,000 camels. God doubled it. God gave him twice as many. "He had 1,000 yoke of oxen." Back in chapter 1, he had 500. "And 1,000 she asses." Back in chapter 1, verse 3, he had 500. So God doubled to him everything he had before. Isn't that a blessing? He got through the trial, and because he got through it right and didn't curse God and didn't do all that, God doubled everything he had. Now here's the question, verse 13. "He also had 7 sons and 3 daughters. What did he have in chapter 1 and verse 2? 7 sons and 3 daughters. Why didn't he double that? Why didn't he give him 14 sons and 6 daughters? Well, let me ask you this. His 7 sons and 3 daughters died in a godly home from a father making sacrifices under good instruction. Did he actually lose them? When they died, will he see them again? He didn't lose them, did he? He lost the sheep. He lost the oxen. He lost the she-asses. He didn't lose the children. They just moved on ahead of him. So when he got through this thing, God gave him 7 more sons and 3 more daughters. God didn't give him another wife because God didn't take the one in the first place. And isn't that an amazing thing? He had 10 more children with that wife that told him, "Curse God and die." Job was a very forgiving man. And he really, anyway, he didn't hold that against her. Apparently, things went on that way. So he got 7 sons and 3 daughters. Now, I'm just going to pass this on to you. And I don't see this, but I've heard it taught that these are the same 7 sons and 3 daughters that he had at the beginning. That God resurrected them at the end and gave them back to Job. Now again, I don't see any indication, and sometimes we take some things, we want to fit a square peg into a round hole. And thinking of Job being a picture of the tribulation and getting restored everything he had before, doubled, there's that resurrection, that first resurrection of things coming back. But it simply tells us that he got double the camels, double the everything else, and the same number of children a second time, more than likely because he's already got the original ones in heaven. And now he's got 7, so he did get double, even of his children. The book of Job. You know, that's kind of a, hey, I never thought of that thing. But you know what I like about the book of Job? It's got some good debate in it, doesn't it? We read in chapter 1, there was a day when the sons of God came and stood before the Lord. Who are the sons of God? Job said over in another chapter, there was a day at creation where the morning stars sang together and the sons of God shouted for joy. Sons of God, angels. Well, in Genesis chapter 6, the sons of God saw the daughters of men. In Job, we read about a creature named Leviathan, another one named Behemoth. Boy, there's great debate about those two. Oh, Leviathan in chapter 41, people say he's a sea monster. That's the Loch Ness monster in chapter 41. Behemoth in chapter 40, well, that's a hippopotamus. But it says about him, he is the chief of the ways of God. That sounds like something more than an animal. That sounds like, we had a fellow here years ago in the old building, and he came and taught us and had a PowerPoint presentation and showed us that Behemoth was actually a dinosaur. And there are people that are grabbing at straws trying to prove things that the Bible does. He's chief of the ways of God. That's not talking about an animal. That's talking about a serpent, and a particular serpent. And this is in the book of Job. So those that think, well, that's just an old primitive book. Well, it's got theology, it's got science, it's even got some very puzzling characters in it that we try to figure out to this day and don't really understand everything. The book of Job is an amazing book. And it's introducing us into the books of wisdom. Now we got 150 chapters of Psalms to fit into one lesson next Wednesday night. We'll see how that works out. Let's all stand together this evening.